Then what is a ghost?
I think that a ghost, said Dirk, is someone who died either violently or unexpectedly with unfinished business on his, her, or its hands, who cannot rest until it's been finished or put right. He turned to face them again. Which is why, he said, a time machine would have such a fascination for a ghost once it knew of its existence. A time machine provides the means to put right what, in the ghost's opinion, went wrong in the past, to free it. Which is why it will be back. It tried first to take possession of Reg himself, but he resisted. Then came the incident with the conjuring trick, the face powder, and the horse in the bathroom, which I... He paused, which even I do not understand, though I intend to if it kills me. And then you, Richard, appear on the scene. The ghost deserts Reg and concentrates instead on you. Almost immediately, there occurs an odd but significant incident. You do something that you then wished you hadn't done. I refer, of course, to the phone call you made to Susan and left on her answering machine. The ghost seizes its chance and tries to induce you to undo it, to, as it were, go back into the past and erase that message, to change the mistake you had made, just to see if you would do it, just to see if it was in your character. If it had been, you would now be totally under its control. But at the very last second, your nature rebelled and you would not do it. And so the ghost gives you up as a bad job and deserts you in turn. It must find someone else. How long has it been doing this? I do not know. Does this now make sense to you? Do you recognize the truth of what I'm saying? Richard turned cold. Yes, he said. I think you must be absolutely right. And at what moment, then, said Dirk, did the ghost leave you? Richard swallowed. When Michael Wenton Weeks walked out of the room, he said. So I wonder, said Dirk quietly, what possibilities the ghost saw in him. I wonder whether this time it found what it wanted. I believe we shall not have long to wait. There was a knock on the door. When it opened, there stood Michael Wenton Weeks. He said simply, please, I need your help. Reg and Richard stared at Dirk and then at Michael. Do you mind if I put this down somewhere? Said Michael. It's rather heavy, full of scuba diving equipment. Oh, I see, said Susan. Oh, well, thanks, Nicola. I'll try that fingering. I'm sure he only put the E-flat in there just to annoy people. Yes, I've been at it solidly all afternoon. Some of those semi-quaver runs in the second movement are absolute bastards. Well, yes, it helped take my mind off it all. No, no news. It's all just mystifying and absolutely horrible. I don't want to even... Look, maybe I'll give you a call again later and see how you're feeling. I know, yes, you never know which is worse, do you? The illness, the antibiotics, or the doctor's bedside manner. Look after yourself, or at least make sure Simon does. Tell him to bring you gallons of hot lemon. Okay, well, I'll talk to you later. Keep warm. Bye now. She put the phone down and returned to her cello. She had hardly started to reconsider the problem of the irritating E-flat when the phone went again. She had simply left it off the hook for the afternoon, but had forgotten to do so after making her own call. With a sigh, she propped up the cello, put down the bow, and went to the phone again. Hello? She demanded. Again, there was nothing. Just a distant cry of wind. Irritably, she slammed the receiver back down once more. She waited for a few seconds for the line to clear, and then was about to take the phone off the hook once more, when she realized that perhaps Richard might need her. She hesitated. She admitted to herself that she hadn't been using the answering machine because she usually just put it on for Gordon's convenience, and that was something of which she did not currently wish to be reminded. Still, she put the answering machine on, turned the volume right down, and returned again to the E-flat that Mozart had put in only to annoy cellists. In the darkness of the offices of Dirk Gently's holistic detective agency, Gordon Way clumsily fumbled the telephone receiver back onto its rest and sat slumped in the deepest dejection. He didn't even stop himself slumping all the way through the seat until he rested lightly on the floor. Miss Pierce had fled the office the first time the telephone had started actually using itself, her patience with all this sort of thing finally exhausted again, since which time Gordon had had the office to himself. However, his attempts to contact anybody had failed completely, or rather, his attempts to contact Susan, which was all he cared about. It was Susan he had been speaking to when he died, and he knew he had somehow to speak to her again, but she had left her phone off the hook most of the afternoon, and even when she had answered, she could not hear him. He gave up. He roused himself from the floor, stood up, and slipped out and down into the darkening streets. He drifted aimlessly for a while, went for a walk on the canal, which was a trick that palled very quickly, and then wandered back up to the street again. The houses, with light and life streaming from them, upset him most particularly, since the welcome they seemed to extend would not be extended to him. He wondered if anyone would mind if he simply slipped into their house and watched television for the evening. He wouldn't be any trouble. Or a cinema. That would be better. He could go to the cinema. He turned with more positive, if still insubstantial, footsteps into Noel Road and started to walk up it. Noel Road, he thought. It rang a vague bell. He had a feeling he'd recently had some dealings with someone in Noel Road. Who was it? His thoughts were interrupted by a terrible scream of horror that rang through the street. He stood stock still. A few seconds later, a door flew open a few yards from him, and a woman ran out of it, wild-eyed and howling. Chapter 31 Richard had never liked Michael Wenton Weeks, and he liked him even less with a ghost in him. He couldn't say why. He had nothing against ghosts personally, didn't think a person should be judged adversely simply for being dead, but he didn't like it. Nevertheless, it was hard not to feel a little sorry for him. Michael sat forlornly on a stool, with his elbow resting on the large table and his head resting on his fingers. He looked ill and haggard. He looked deeply tired. He looked pathetic. His story had been a harrowing one, and concluded with his attempts to possess first Reg and then Richard. "You were," he concluded, "right, entirely." He said this last to Dirk, and Dirk grimaced as if trying not to beam with triumph too many times in a day. The voice was Michael's, and yet it was not Michael's. Whatever timbre a voice acquires through a billion or so years of dread and isolation, this voice had acquired it, and it filled those who heard it with a dizzying chill akin to that which clutches the mind and stomach when standing on a cliff at night. He turned his eyes on Reg and on Richard, and the effect of the eyes, too, was one that provoked pity and terror. Richard had to look away. "I owe you both an apology," said the ghost within Michael, "which I offer to you from the depths of my heart, and only hope that as you come to understand the desperation of my predicament, and the hope which this machine offers me, you will understand why I have acted as I have, and that you will find it within yourselves to forgive me, and to help me, I beg you." "Give the man a whiskey," said Dirk gruffly.
Haven't got any whiskey," said Reg. "Port, there's a bottle or so of Margot I could open, a very fine one. Should be chambrayed for an hour, but I can do that, of course. It's very easy.
"Will you help me?" interrupted the ghost. Reg bustled to fetch some port and some glasses. "Why have you taken over the body of this man?" said Dirk. "I need to have a voice with which to speak and a body with which to act. No harm will come to him, no harm." "Let me ask the question again. Why have you taken over the body of this man?" insisted Dirk. The ghost made Michael's body shrug. He was willing. Both of these two gentlemen, quite understandably, resisted being, hypnotized. Your analogy is fair. This one, well, I think his sense of self is at a low ebb, and he has acquiesced. I am very grateful to him and will not do him any harm. "His sense of self," repeated Dirk thoughtfully, "is at a low ebb." "I suppose that's probably true," said Richard quietly to Dirk. "He seemed very depressed last night. The one thing that was important to him had been taken away because he wasn't really very good at it. Although he's proud, I expect he was probably quite receptive to the idea of actually being wanted for something." "Hmm," said Dirk, and said it again. He said it a third time with feeling. Then he whirled around and barked at the figure on the stool. "Michael Wenton Weeks!" Michael's head jolted back, and he blinked. "Yes," he said in his normal lugubrious voice. His eyes followed Dirk as he moved. "You can hear me," said Dirk, "and you can answer for yourself." "Oh, yes," said Michael, "most certainly I can." "This being, this spirit, you know he is in you, you accept his presence, you are a willing party to what he wishes to do?"
"That is correct. I was much moved by his account of himself, and I am very willing to help him. In fact, I think it is right for me to do so."
"All right," said Dirk with a snap of his fingers. "You can go." Michael's head slumped forward suddenly, and then, after a second or so, it slowly rose again, as if being pumped up from inside like a tire. The ghost was back in possession. Dirk took hold of a chair, spun it round, and sat astride it, facing the ghost in Michael, peering intently into its eyes. Again, he said. Tell me again. A quick snap account. Michael's body tensed slightly. It reached out to Dirk's arm.
Don't touch me, snapped Dirk. Just tell me the facts. The first time you try and make me feel sorry for you, I'll poke you in the eye. Or at least the one you borrowed. So leave out all the stuff that sounded like, Coleridge, said Richard suddenly. It sounded exactly like Coleridge. It was like the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. Well, bits of it were.
Dirk frowned. Coleridge, he said. I tried to tell him my story, admitted the ghost.
Sorry, said Dirk. You'll have to excuse me. I've never cross-examined a 4-billion-year-old ghost before. Are we talking Samuel Taylor here? Are we saying you told your story to Samuel Taylor Coleridge?
I was able to enter his mind at certain times when he was in an impressionable state.
You mean when he was on laudanum? Said Richard.
That is correct. He was more relaxed then.
I'll say, snorted Reg. I sometimes encountered him when he was quite astoundingly relaxed. Look, I'll make some coffee.
He disappeared into the kitchen, where he could be heard laughing to himself.
It's another world, muttered Richard to himself, sitting down and shaking his head.
But unfortunately, when he was fully in possession of himself, I, so to speak, was not, said the ghost, and so that failed, and what he wrote was very garbled.
Discuss, said Richard to himself, raising his eyebrows. Professor, called out Dirk, this may sound absurd. Did Coleridge ever try to use your time machine? Feel free to discuss the question in any way which appeals to you.
Well, do you know, said Reg, looking round the door, he did come in prying around on one occasion, but I think he was in a great deal too relaxed a state to do anything.
I see, said Dirk. But why, he added, turning back to the strange figure of Michael slumped on its stool, why has it taken you so long to find someone?
For long, long periods I am very weak, almost totally non-existent, and unable to influence anything at all. And then, of course, before that time, there was no time machine here and no hope for me at all.
Perhaps ghosts exist like wave patterns, suggested Richard, like interference patterns between the actual with the possible. There would be irregular peaks and troughs, like in a musical waveform.
The ghost snapped Michael's eyes round to Richard.
Hugh, he said, you wrote that article.
Yes.
It moved me very greatly, said the ghost, with a sudden remorseful longing in his voice, which seemed to catch itself almost as much by surprise as it did its listeners.
Oh, I see, said Richard. Well, thank you. You didn't like it so much last time you mentioned it.
Well, I know that wasn't you as such.
Richard sat back, frowning to himself. So, said Dirk, to return to the beginning.
The ghost gathered Michael's breath for him and started again.
We were on a ship, it said.
A spaceship?
Yes. Out from Salaxala, a world in, well, very far from here. A violent and troubled place. We, a party of some 9 dozen of us, set out, as people frequently did, to find a new world for ourselves. All the planets in the system were completely unsuitable for our purpose, but we stopped on this world to replenish some necessary mineral supplies. Unfortunately, our landing ship was damaged on its way into the atmosphere, damaged quite badly, but still reparable. I was the engineer on board, and it fell to me to supervise the task of repairing the ship and preparing it to return to our main ship. Now, in order to understand what happened next, you must know something of the nature of a highly automated society. There is no task that cannot be done more easily with the aid of advanced computerization, and there were some very specific problems associated with a trip with an aim such as ours.
Which was? Said Dirk sharply.
The ghost in Michael blinked as if the answer was obvious.
Well, to find a new and better world on which we could all live in freedom, peace and harmony for ever, of course, he said.
Dirk raised his eyebrows.
Oh, that, he said. You'd thought this all out carefully, I assume.
We'd had it thought out for us. We had with us some very specialized devices for helping us to continue to believe in the purpose of the trip, even when things got difficult. They generally worked very well, but I think we probably came to rely on them too much.
What on earth were they? Said Dirk.
It's probably hard for you to understand how reassuring they were, and that was why I made my fatal mistake. When I wanted to know whether or not it was safe to take off, I didn't want to know that it might not be safe. I just wanted to be reassured that it was. So instead of checking it myself, you see, I sent out one of the electric monks. Chapter 32. The brass plaque on the red door in Peckender Street glittered as it reflected the yellow light of a street lamp. It glared for a moment as it reflected the violent flashing light of a passing police car sweeping by. It dimmed slightly as a pale, pale wraith slipped silently through it. It glimmered as it dimmed because the wraith was trembling with such terrible agitation. In the dark hallway, the ghost of Gordon Way paused. He needed something to lean on for support, and of course there was nothing. He tried to get a grip on himself, but there was nothing to get a grip on. He retched at the horror of what he had seen, but there was, of course, nothing in his stomach. He half stumbled, half swam up the stairs like a drowning man trying to grapple for a grip on the water. He staggered through the wall, through the desk, through the door, and tried to compose and settle himself in front of the desk in Dirk's office. If anyone had happened into the office a few minutes later, a night cleaner perhaps, if Dirk Gently had ever employed one, which he didn't on the grounds that they wished to be paid and he didn't wish to pay them, or a burglar perhaps, if there had been anything in the office worth burgling, which there wasn't, they would have seen the following sight and been amazed by it. The receiver of the large red telephone on the desk suddenly rocked and tumbled off its rest onto the desktop. A dialing tone started to burr. Then one by one, seven of the large, easily pushed buttons depressed themselves. And after the very long pause, which the British telephone system allows you within which to gather your thoughts and forget who it is you're phoning, the sound of a phone ringing at the other end of the line could be heard. After a couple of rings, there was a click, a whir, and a sound as of a machine drawing breath. Then a voice started to say, "Hello, this is Susan. I can't come to the phone right at the moment because I'm trying to get an E-flat right, but if you'd like to leave your name..." So then, on the say-so of an, I can hardly bring myself to utter the words, electric monk, said Dirk, in a voice ringing with derision, "you attempt to launch the ship, and to your utter astonishment, it explodes." "Since when?" "Since when," said the ghost abjectly, "I have been alone on this planet. Alone with the knowledge of what I had done to my fellows on the ship. All alone." "Yes, skip that," I said, said Dirk angrily. "What about the main ship? That presumably went on and continued its search for..." "No." "Then what happened to it?" "Nothing. It's still there." "Still there?" Dirk leapt to his feet and whirled off to pace the room, his brow furiously furrowed. "Yes." Michael's head drooped a little, but he looked up piteously at Reg and at Richard. "All of us were aboard the landing craft. At first I felt myself to be haunted by the ghosts of the rest, but it was only in my imagination. For millions of years, and then billions, I stalked the mud utterly alone. It is impossible for you to conceive of even the tiniest part of the torment of such eternity." "Then," he added, "just recently life arose on the planet. Life, vegetation, things in the sea. Then at last you, intelligent life, I turn to you to release me from the torment I have endured." Michael's head sank abjectly onto his chest for some seconds. Then slowly, wobblingly, it rose and stared at them again with yet darker fires in his eyes. "Take me back," he said. "I beg you, take me back to the landing craft. Let me undo what was done. A word from me and it can be undone. The repairs properly made. The landing craft can then return to the main ship. We can be on our way. My torment will be extinguished and I will cease to be a burden to you. I beg you." There was a short silence while his plea hung in the air. "But that can't work, can it?" said Richard. "If we do that, then this won't have happened. Don't we generate all sorts of paradoxes?" Reg stirred himself and thought. "Oh, no worse than many that exist already," he said. "If the universe came to an end every time there was some uncertainty about what had happened in it, it would never have got beyond the first picosecond. And many, of course, don't. It's like a human body, you see. A few cuts and bruises here and there don't hurt it. Not even major surgery if it's done properly. Paradoxes are just the scar tissue. Time and space heal themselves up around them, and people simply remember a version of events which makes as much sense as they require it to make. That isn't to say that if you get involved in a paradox, a few things won't strike you as being very odd, but if you got through life without that already happening to you, then I don't know which universe you've been living in, but it isn't this one. Well, if that's the case, said Richard, why were you so fierce about not doing anything to save the dodo?
Reg sighed. You don't understand it at all. The dodo wouldn't have died if I hadn't worked so hard to save the coelacanth.
The coelacanth? The prehistoric fish? But how could one possibly affect the other?
Ah, now there you're asking. The complexities of cause and effect defy analysis. Not only is the continuum like a human body, it's also very like a piece of badly put up wallpaper. Push down a bubble somewhere, another one pops up somewhere else. There are no more dodos because of my interference. In the end, I imposed the rule on myself because I simply couldn't bear it any more. The only thing that really gets hurt when you try and change time is yourself. He smiled bleakly and looked away. Then he added, after a long moment's reflection, No, it can be done. I'm just cynical because it's gone wrong so many times. This poor fellow's story is a very pathetic one, and it can do no harm to put an end to his misery. It happened so very, very long ago on a dead planet. If we do this, we will each remember whatever it is that has happened to us individually. Too bad if the rest of the world doesn't quite agree. It'll hardly be the first time. Michael's head bowed.
You're very silent, Dirk, said Richard.
Dirk glared angrily at him. I want to see this ship, he demanded.
In the darkness, the red telephone receiver slipped and slid fitfully back across the desk. If anybody had been there to see it, they might just have discerned a shape that moved it. It shone only very faintly, less than with the hands of a luminous watch. It seemed more as if the darkness around it was just that much darker, and the ghostly shape within it like thickened scar tissue beneath the surface of the night. Gordon grappled one last time with the recalcitrant receiver. At length, he got a final grip and slipped up onto the top of the instrument. From there, it fell back onto its rest and disconnected the call. At the same moment, the ghost of Gordon Way, his last call finally completed, fell back to his own rest and vanished.
Chapter 33. Swinging slowly round in the shadow of the earth, just one more piece of debris among that which floated now forever in high orbit, was one dark shape that was larger and more regularly formed than the rest, and far, far older. For 4 billion years it had continued to absorb data from the world below it, scanning, analysing, processing. Occasionally it sent pieces back if it thought they would help. But otherwise it watched, it listened. It recorded. Not the lapping of a wave nor the beating of a heart escaped its attention. Otherwise, nothing inside it had moved for 4 billion years, except the air which circulated still and the motes of dust within the air that danced and danced and danced and danced and danced. It was only a very slight disturbance that occurred now, quietly, without fuss. Like a dewdrop precipitating from the air onto a leaf, there appeared, in a wall which had stood blank and grey for 4 billion years, a door. A plain, ordinary, white-panelled door with a small, dented, brass handle. This quiet event, too, was recorded and incorporated in the continual stream of data processing that the ship ceaselessly performed. Not only the arrival of the door, but the arrival of those behind the door. The way they looked, the way they moved, the way they felt about being there, all processed, all recorded, all transformed. After a moment or two had passed, the door opened. Within it could be seen a room unlike any on the ship, a room of wooden floors, of shabby upholstery, a room in which a fire danced. And as the fire danced, its data danced within the ship's computers, and the motes of dust in the air also danced with it. A figure stood in the doorway. A large, lugubrious figure with a strange light that danced now in its eyes. It stepped forward across the threshold into the ship, and its face was suddenly suffused with a calm for which it had longed but had thought never again to experience. Following him stepped out a smaller, older man with hair that was white and wayward. He stopped and blinked with wonder as he passed from out of the realm of his room and into the realm of the ship. Following him came a third man,
impatient and tense, with a large leather overcoat that flapped about him. He too stopped and was momentarily bewildered by something he didn't understand. With a look of deepest puzzlement on his face, he walked forward and looked around at the grey and dusty walls of the ancient ship. At last came a fourth man, tall and thin. He stooped as he walked out of the door, and then instantly stopped, as if he'd walked into a wall. He had walked into a wall of a kind. He stood transfixed. If anyone had been looking at his face at that moment, it would have been abundantly clear to them that the single most astonishing event of this man's entire existence was currently happening to him. When slowly he began to move, it was with a curious gait, as if he was swimming very slowly. Each tiniest movement of his head seemed to bring fresh floods of awe and astonishment into his face. Tears welled in his eyes, and he became breathless with gasping wonder. Dirk turned to look at him, to hurry him along. "What's the matter?" he called above the noise.
"The music," whispered Richard. The air was full of music. So full it seemed there was room for nothing else. And each particle of air seemed to have its own music, so that as Richard moved his head, he heard a new and different music, though the new and different music fitted quite perfectly with the music that lay beside it in the air. The modulations from one to another were perfectly accomplished, astonishing leaps to different keys made effortlessly in the mere shifting of the head. New themes, new strands of melody, all perfectly and astoundingly proportioned, constantly involved themselves into the continuing web. Huge, slow waves of movement, faster dances that thrilled through them, tiny scintillating scampers that danced on the dances, long, tangled tunes whose ends were so like their beginnings that they twisted around upon themselves, twisted inside out, upside down, and then rushed off again on the back of yet another dancing melody in a distant part of the ship. Richard staggered against the wall. Dirk hurried to grab him.
"Come on," he said briskly. "What's the matter? Can't you stand the music? It's just a bit loud, isn't it? For God's sake, pull yourself together. There's something here I still don't understand. It's not right. Come on."
He tugged Richard after him, and then had to support him as Richard's mind sank further and further under the overwhelming weight of music. The visions that were woven in his mind by the million thrilling threads of music, as they were pulled through it, were increasingly a welter of chaos. But the more the chaos burgeoned, the more it fitted with the other chaos and the next greater chaos, until it all became a vast exploding ball of harmony, expanding in his mind faster than any mind could deal with. And then it was all much simpler. A single tune danced through his mind, and all his attention rested upon it. It was a tune that seethed through the magical flood, shaped it, formed it, lived through it hugely, lived through it minutely, was its very essence. It bounced and trilled along, at first a little tripping tune, then it slowed, then it danced again, but with more difficulty, seemed to founder in eddies of doubt and confusion, and then suddenly revealed that the eddies were just the first ripples of a huge new wave of energy surging up joyfully from beneath. Richard began, very, very slowly, to faint. He lay very still. He felt he was an old sponge steeped in paraffin and left in the sun to dry. He felt like the body of an old horse burning hazily in the sun. He dreamed of oil, thin and fragrant, of dark heaving seas. He was on a white beach, drunk with fish, stupefied with sand, bleached, drowsing, pummeled with light, sinking, estimating the density of vapour clouds and distant nebulae, spinning with dead delight. He was a pump spouting fresh water in the springtime, gushing into a mound of reeking new-mown grass. Sounds, almost unheard, burned away like distant sleep. He ran and was falling. The lights of a harbour spun into night. The sea, like a dark spirit, slapped infinitesimally at the sand, glimmering, unconscious. Out where it was deeper and colder, he sank easily with the heavy sea swelling like oil around his ears, and was disturbed only by a distant burr, burr, as of the phone ringing. He knew he had been listening to the music of life itself.
the music of light dancing on water that rippled with the wind and the tides, of the life that moved through the water, of the life that moved on the land, warmed by the light. He continued to lie very still, continued to be disturbed by a distant burr, burr, as of a phone ringing. Gradually he became aware that the distant burr, burr, as of a phone ringing was a phone ringing. He sat up sharply. He was lying on a small crumpled bed in a small, untidy panelled room that he knew he recognised but couldn't place. It was cluttered with books and shoes. He blinked at it and was blank. The phone by the bed was ringing. He picked it up. "Hello?" he said. "Richard!" It was Susan's voice, utterly distraught. He shook his head and had no recollection of anything useful. "Hello?" he said again. "Richard, is that you? Where are you?" "Hold on, I'll go and look." He put the receiver down on the crumpled sheets, where it lay squawking, climbed shakily off the bed, and staggered to the door and opened it. Here was a bathroom. He peered at it suspiciously. Again he recognised it, but felt that there was something missing. Oh yes, there should be a horse in it, or at least there had been a horse in it the last time he had seen it. He crossed the bathroom floor and went out of the other door. He found his way shakily down the stairs and into Reg's main room. He was surprised by what he saw when he got there. Chapter 34. The storms of the day before and of the day before that, and the floods of the previous week, had now abated. The sky still bulged with rain, but all that actually fell in the gathering evening gloom was a dreary kind of prickle. Some wind whipped across the darkening plain, blundered through the low hills, and gusted across a shallow valley, where stood a structure, a kind of tower, alone in a nightmare of mud and leaning. It was a blackened stump of a tower. It stood like an extrusion of magma from one of the more pestilential pits of hell, and it leaned at a peculiar angle, as if oppressed by something altogether more terrible than its own considerable weight. It seemed a dead thing, long ages dead. The only movement was that of a river of mud that moved sluggishly along the bottom of the valley past the tower. A mile or so further on, the river ran down a ravine and disappeared underground. But, as the evening darkened, it became apparent that the tower was not entirely without life. There was a single, dim, red light guttering deep within it. It was this scene that Richard was surprised to see from a small, white doorway set in the side of the valley wall, a few hundred yards from the tower. "Don't step out," said Dirk, putting up an arm. "The atmosphere is poisonous. I'm not sure what's in it, but it would certainly get your carpets nice and clean." Dirk was standing in the doorway, watching the valley with deep mistrust. "Where are we?" asked Richard. "Somewhere in the Bahamas," said Dirk. "It's a bit complicated." "Thank you," said Richard, and walked groggily back across the room. "Excuse me," he said to Reg, who was busy fussing around Michael Wenton Weeks, making sure that the scuba diving suit he was wearing fitted snugly everywhere, that the mask was secure, and that the regulator for the air supply was working properly. "Sorry, can I just get past?" said Richard. "Thanks." He climbed back up the stairs, went back into Reg's room, sat shakily on the edge of the bed, and picked up the phone again. "The Bahamas," he said. "It's a bit complicated." Downstairs, Reg finished smearing Vaseline on all the joins of the suit and a few pieces of exposed skin around the mask, and then announced that all was ready. Dirk swung himself away from the door and stood aside with the utmost bad grace. "Well then," he said, "be off with you. Good riddance. I wash my hands of the whole affair. I suppose we'll have to wait here for you to send back the empty, for what it's worth." He stalked round the sofa with an angry gesture. He didn't like this. He didn't like any of it. He particularly didn't like Reg knowing more about space-time than he did. It made him angry that he didn't know why he didn't like it. "My dear fellow," said Reg in a conciliatory tone, "consider what a very small effort it is for us to help the poor soul. I'm sorry if it seems to you an anticlimax after all your extraordinary feats of deduction. I know you feel that a mere errand of mercy seems not enough for you, but you should be more charitable." "Charitable? Ha!" said Dirk. "I pay my taxes. What more do you want?" He threw himself on the sofa, ran his hands through his hair, and sulked. The possessed figure of Michael shook hands with Reg and said a few words of thanks. Then he walked stiffly to the door, turned, and bowed to them. Dirk flung his head round and stared at him, his eyes flashing behind their spectacles and his hair flying wildly. The ghost looked at Dirk and for a moment shivered inside with apprehension. A superstitious instinct suddenly made the ghost wave. He waved Michael's hand round in a circle three times, and then said a single word. "Goodbye," he said. With that he turned again, gripped the sides of the doorway, and stepped resolutely out into the mud and into the foul and poisonous wind. He paused for a moment to be sure this footing was solid, that he had his balance, and then, without another look back, he walked away from them, out of the reach of the slimy things with legs, towards his ship. "Now what on earth did that mean?" said Dirk, irritably mimicking the odd triple wave. Richard came thundering down the stairs, threw open the door and plunged into the room, wild-eyed. "Ross has been murdered!" he shouted. "Who the hell's Ross?" shouted Dirk back at him. "What's his name, Ross, for God's sake?" exclaimed Richard. "The new editor of Fathom!" "What's Fathom?" shouted Dirk again. "Michael's bloody magazine, Dirk. Remember, Gordon chucked Michael off the magazine and gave it to this Ross guy to run instead. Michael hated him for that. Well, last night, Michael went and bloody murdered him." He paused, panting. "At least," he said, "he was murdered, and Michael was the only one with any reason to." He ran to the door, looking out at the retreating figure disappearing into the gloom, and spun round again. "Is he coming back?" said Richard. Dirk leapt to his feet and stood blinking for a moment. "That's it," he said. "That's why Michael was the perfect subject. That's what I should have been looking for. The thing the ghost made him do in order to establish his hold, the thing he had to be fundamentally willing to do, the thing that would match the ghost's own purpose. Oh, my dear God, he thinks we've supplanted them, and that's what he wants to reverse. He thinks this is their world, not ours. This was where they were going to settle and build their blasted paradise. It matches every step of the way. You see," he said, turning on Reg, "what we have done? I would not be surprised to discover that the accident your poor tormented soul out there is trying to reverse is the very thing which started life on this planet." He turned his eyes suddenly from Reg, who was white and trembling, back to Richard. "When did you hear this?" he said, puzzled.
"Just now," said Richard, on the phone, upstairs."
"What?"
"It was Susan. I don't know how. She said she had a message on her answering machine telling her about it. She said the message was from..." "She said it was from Gordon, but I think she was hysterical. Dirk, what the hell is happening? Where are we?"
"We are 4 billion years in the past," said Reg in a shaking voice. "Please don't ask me why it is that the phone works when we're anywhere in the universe other than where it's actually connected. That's a matter you'll have to take up with British Telecom, but..."
"Damn and blast British Telecom!" shouted Dirk, the words coming easily from force of habit. He ran to the door and peered again at the dim, shadowy figure trudging through the mud towards the Salaxilan ship, completely beyond their reach.
"How long," said Dirk quite calmly, "would you guess that it's going to take that fat, self-deluding bastard to reach his ship? Because that is how long we have. Come, let us sit down, let us think. We have 2 minutes in which to decide what we're going to do. After that, I very much suspect that the three of us and everything we have ever known, including the coelacanth and the dodo, dear Professor, will cease ever to have existed."
He sat heavily on the sofa, then stood up again and removed Michael's discarded jacket from under him. As he did so, a book fell out of the pocket. Chapter 35.
"I think it's an appalling act of desecration," said Richard to Reg, as they sat hiding behind a hedge. The night was full of summer smells from the cottage garden, and the occasional whiff of sea air which came in on the light breezes that were entertaining themselves on the coast of the Bristol Channel. There was a bright moon playing over the sea off in the distance, and by its light it was also possible to see some distance over Exmoor, stretching away to the south of them. Reg sighed.
"Yes, maybe," he said, "but I'm afraid he's right, you know. It must be done. It was the only sure way. All the instructions were clearly contained in the piece, once you knew what you were looking for. It has to be suppressed. The ghost will always be around. In fact, two of him now, that is, assuming this works. Poor devil. Still, I suppose he brought it on himself." Richard fretfully pulled up some blades of grass and twisted them between his fingers. He held them up to the moonlight, turned them to different angles, and watched the way light played on them. "Such music," he said.
I'm not religious, but if I were, I would say it was like a glimpse into the mind of God. Perhaps it was, and I ought to be religious. I have to keep reminding myself that they didn't create the music, they only created the instrument which could read the score, and the score was life itself. And it's all up there. He glanced into the sky. Unconsciously, he started to quote, "Could I revive within me her symphony and song? To such a deep delight 'twould win me that with music loud and long I would build that dome in air, that sunny dome, those caves of ice."
"Hmm," said Reg to himself. "I wonder if he arrived early enough."
"What did you say?" said Richard.
"Oh, nothing, just a thought."
"Good God, he can talk, can't he?" Richard exclaimed suddenly. "He's been in there over an hour now. I wonder what's going on."
He got up and looked over the hedge at the small farm cottage basking in the moonlight behind them. About an hour earlier, Dirk had walked boldly up to the front door and rapped on it. When the door had opened, somewhat reluctantly, and a slightly dazed face had looked out, Dirk had doffed his absurd hat and said in a loud voice,
"Mr. Samuel Coleridge? I was just passing by on my way from Porlock, you understand, and I was wondering if I might trouble you to vouchsafe me an interview. It's just for a little parish broadsheet I edit. Won't take much of your time, I promise. I know you must be busy, famous poet like you, but I do so admire your work, and—"
The rest was lost, because by that time Dirk had effected his entry and closed the door behind him.
"Would you excuse me a moment?" said Reg.
"What? Oh, sure," said Richard. "I'm just going to go and have a look and see what's happening."
While Reg wandered off behind a tree, Richard pushed open the little gate and was about to make his way up the path when he heard the sound of voices approaching the front door from within. He hurriedly darted back as the front door started to open.
"Well, thank you very much indeed, Mr. Coleridge," said Dirk as he emerged fiddling with his hat and bowing. "You have been most kind and generous with your time, and I do appreciate it very much, as I'm sure will my readers. I'm sure it'll work up into a very nice little article, a copy of which, you may rest assured, I will send you for you to peruse at your leisure. I will most certainly welcome your comments, if you have any points of style, you know, hints, tips, things of that nature. Well, thank you again so much for your time. I do hope I haven't kept you from anything important."
The door slammed violently behind him. Dirk turned with another in a long succession of triumphant beams and hurried down the path to Richard.
"Well, let's put a stop to that," he said, patting his hands together. "I think he'd made a start on writing it down, but he won't remember another word, that's for certain. Where's the egregious professor? Oh, there you are. Good heavens, I'd no idea it'd been that long. A most fascinating and entertaining fellow are Mr. Coleridge, or at least I'm sure he would have been if I'd given him the chance, but I was rather too busy being fascinating myself. Oh, but I did do as you asked, Richard. I asked him at the end about the albatross, and he said, 'What albatross?' So I said, it wasn't important, the albatross did not signify. He said, 'What albatross didn't signify?' And I said, 'Never mind the albatross, it didn't matter.' And he said, 'It did matter. Someone comes to his house in the middle of the night raving about albatrosses, he wanted to know why. I said, blast the bloody albatross, and he said he had a good mind to. And he wasn't certain that that didn't give him an idea for a poem he was working on. Much better, he said, than being hit by an asteroid, which he thought was stretching credulity a bit. And so I came away. Now, having saved the entire human race from extinction, I could do with a pizza. What do you say to such a proposal?" Richard didn't offer an opinion. He was staring instead with some puzzlement at Reg.
Something troubling you?" said Reg, taken aback.
"That's a good trick," said Richard. "I could have sworn you didn't have a beard before you went behind the tree."
"Oh!" Reg fingered the luxuriant 3-inch growth.
Yes.
He said, "Oh, just carelessness," he said, "carelessness.
What have you been up to?"
"Oh, just a few adjustments, a little surgery, you understand, nothing drastic."
A few minutes later, as he ushered them into the extra door that a nearby cowshed had mysteriously acquired, he looked back up into the sky behind them, just in time to see a small light flare up and disappear. "Sorry, Richard," he muttered, and followed them in.
Chapter 36. "Thank you, no," said Richard firmly. "Much as I would love the opportunity to buy your pizza and watch you eat it, Dirk, I want to go straight home. I have to see Susan. Is that possible, Reg? Just straight to my flat? I'll come up to Cambridge next week and collect my car."
"We are already there," said Reg. "Simply step out of the door and you are at home in your own flat. It's early on Friday evening and the weekend lies before you."
"Thanks. Look, Dirk, I'll see you around, okay? Do I owe you something? I don't know."
Dirk waved the matter aside airily. "You will hear from my Miss Pierce in due course," he said.
"Fine, okay, well, I'll see you when I've had some rest. It's been, well, unexpected."
He walked to the door and opened it. Stepping outside, he found himself halfway up his own staircase, in the wall of which the door had materialized. He was about to start up the stairs when he turned again as a thought struck him. He stepped back in, closing the door behind him. "Reg, could we make one tiny detour?" he said. "I think it'd be a good move if I took Susan out for a meal tonight. And at the place I have in mind, you have to book in advance. Could you manage 3 weeks for me?" "Nothing could be easier," said Reg, and made a subtle adjustment to the disposition of the beads on the abacus. "There," he said, "we have travelled backwards in time 3 weeks." Richard opened the door again and hurried upstairs to phone L'Esprit d'Escalier. The maitre d' was charmed and delighted to take his reservation and looked forward to seeing him in 3 weeks' time. Richard went back downstairs, shaking his head in wonder. "I need a weekend of solid reality," he said. "Who is that just going out of the door?" "That," said Dirk, "was your sofa being delivered. The man asked if we minded him opening the door so they could manoeuvre it round, and I said we would be delighted." It was only a few minutes later that Richard found himself hurrying up the stairs to Susan's flat. As he arrived at her front door, he was pleased, as he always was, to hear the deep tones of her cello coming faintly from within. He quietly let himself in, and then, as he walked to the door of her music room, he suddenly froze in astonishment. The tune she was playing was one he had heard before, a little tripping tune that slowed, then danced again, but with more difficulty. His face was so amazed that she stopped playing the instant she saw him. "What's wrong?" she said, alarmed. "Where did you get that music?" said Richard in a whisper. She shrugged. "Well, from the music shop," she said, puzzled. She wasn't being facetious, she simply didn't understand the question. "What is it?" "It's from a cantata I'm playing in a couple of weeks," she said. "Bach, number 6. Who wrote it?" "Well, Bach, I expect, if you think about it."
"Who?"
"Watch my lips. Bach. B-A-C-H. Johann Sebastian, remember?"
No, never heard of him."
Who is he? Did he write anything else?" Susan put down her bow, propped up her cello, stood up and came over to him. "Are you all right?" she said.
It's rather hard to tell. What's..."
He caught sight of a pile of music books sitting in a corner of the room with the same name on the top one, Bach. He threw himself at the pile and started to scrabble through it, book after book. J.S. Bach, cello sonatas, Brandenburg concertos, a mass in B minor. He looked up at her in blank incomprehension.
"I've never seen any of this before," he said.
"Richard, my darling," she said, putting her hand to his cheek, "what on earth's the matter? It's just Bach sheet music."
"But don't you understand," he said, shaking a handful of the stuff, "I've never, ever seen any of this before."
"Well," she said with mock gravity, "perhaps if you didn't spend all your time playing with computer music." He looked at her with wild surprise, then slowly he sat back against the wall and began to laugh hysterically. On Monday afternoon, Richard phoned Reg. "Reg," he said, "your phone is working. Congratulations." "Oh, yes, my dear fellow," said Reg. "How delightful to hear from you. Yes, a very capable young man arrived and fixed the phone a little earlier. I don't think it'll go wrong again now. Good news, don't you think?" "Very good. You got back safely, then?" "Oh, yes, thank you. Oh, we had high excitement here when we returned from dropping you off. Remember the horse? Well, he turned up again with his owner. They'd had some unfortunate encounter with the constabulary and wished to be taken home. Just as well, dangerous sort of chap to have on the loose, I think. So, how are you, then?"
"Reg, the music."
"Ah, yes, I thought you'd be pleased. Took a bit of work, I can tell you. I saved only the tiniest scrap, of course, but even so, I cheated. It was rather more than one man could actually do in a lifetime, but I don't suppose anyone will look at that too seriously."
"Reg, can't we get some more of it?"
"Well, no, the ship has gone, and besides..." "We could go back in time." "No, well, I told you, they fixed the phone so it won't go wrong again."
"So?"
"Well, the time machine won't work now. Burnt out. Dead as a dodo. I think that's it, I'm afraid. Probably just as well, though, don't you think?"
On Monday, Mrs. Sorskind phoned Dirk Gently's holistic detective agency to complain about her bill.
"I don't understand what all this is about," she said. "It's complete nonsense. What's the meaning of it?"
"My dear Mrs. Sorskent," he said, "I can hardly tell you how much I've been looking forward to having this exact same conversation with you yet again. Where shall we begin today? Which particular item is it that you would like to discuss?" "None of them, thank you very much, Mr. Gently. I do not know who you are or why you should think my cat is missing. Dear Roderick passed away in my arms 2 years ago, and I have not wished to replace him." Mrs. Sorskind," said Dirk, "what you probably fail to appreciate is that it is as a direct result of my efforts that, if I might explain about the interconnectedness of all..." He stopped. It was pointless. He slowly dropped the telephone back on its cradle. "Miss Pierce," he called out, "kindly send out a revised bill, would you, to our dear Mrs. Sorskind. The new bill reads, 2, Saving Human Race from Total Extinction. No charge." He put on his hat and left for the day.
Copyright 1997, Dove Audio Incorporated. If you would like to receive a Dove Audio or Dove Kids catalog, please call 1-800-328-3683 or 1-800-328-DOVE.